Hey everybody, welcome to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff, and this week on the show joining me is Lynn Sparrow Christie. Lynn is a teacher, writer, and hypnotherapist life coach with more than 40 years' experience in both traditional and alternative approaches to spirituality and personal growth. Lynn is committed to helping today's spiritual seekers find authentic and practical pathways to growth. Her latest book, published recently by ARE Press, addresses the evolutionary aspects of the Cayce readings, and it's entitled Beyond Soul Growth, Awakening to the Call of Cosmic Evolution. She's also a regular mentor for ARE's online learning e-group programs. She'll be joining John Van Auken for the new Virginia Beach conference entitled Christ and Christmas Today, Experiencing the Kingdom Within. And this takes place on December 7th of this year. I hope you all enjoy my interview with Lynn Sparrow Christie. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Lynn. I really appreciate it.
I'm delighted to be here.
And I was wondering if you could tell me, for the listeners, how and when did you first get introduced to the Edgar Cayce material in the ARE?
Well, that goes back a ways, because I was still in my mid-teens when I discovered Edgar Cayce.
Oh, wow.
I had actually had a pretty strong religious and spiritual orientation from childhood, and my early kind of Baptist Christianity had blossomed out into an interest in other religions of the world, and so I was reading a lot about world religions, and I had another interest side by side with it that I had not yet tied together with my interest in spirituality, and that was a deep interest in the paranormal. I always loved those stories about psychics helping police find missing people and things like that.
Right.
And when I happened upon, and I say happened with quotation marks around it because we all know what that's all about, the right book at the right time comes into our hands. When I read about Edgar Cayce, it was like these previously disparate strands came together with his core linking of psychic with the soul. And I realized that his more universal approach to spirituality was a perfect reflection of where my own inner leading and studies were taking me. And he put that whole world of the paranormal in a much richer, more meaningful context. So I became just an avid reader of Edgar Cayce books, attender of conferences in Virginia Beach, because I didn't live here in Virginia Beach at the time. So by the time I got out of college, I was ready to move to Virginia Beach and be a little bit more closely involved in the work. It's interesting how we can find the depth we need in any spiritual tradition if we're willing to do the work.
That's so true. Wow. That's great. And I understand that you have an upcoming book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I'm real excited about it. It's called Beyond Soul Growth, Awakening to the Call of Cosmic Evolution. It's about the spiritual path that puts our efforts at growth and awakening in a context that's a little bit wider than our personal development or what we might call our own soul growth or soul development. Instead, it places our spiritual development as part and parcel of a single evolution that involves the cosmos we live in, the biological world, and consciousness itself.
That sounds fantastic.
Well, it's been my passion for a number of years now, and it took a while to come to the point where I was ready to write about it.
Yeah.
It had begun kind of coming through some of my own inner inquiries. I've been involved with an inspirational writing process for more than a decade now, and intimations of this began kind of breaking through. And I thought at the time that it was a brand new idea. And of course, what we always find is there's nothing new under the sun, really.
Right.
And I subsequently found that I had just stepped into a stream of evolutionary thought that had a lot of antecedents to it. And as you probably know, Brent, one of the things that can be most confirming on the spiritual path is when some insight or some awareness or some idea comes to us, it feels original with us, and then we later encounter it elsewhere. There is that sense that there is one revelation of truth that we can all tap into in our own way. And it's one of the most confirming experiences that I think we can ever have on the past.
Right. And you say your book is about evolutionary spirituality. For those who aren't familiar, what exactly is that and what distinguishes it from the other spiritual paths?
Well, in one sense, of course, all spiritual paths are evolutionary if they call us to grow and develop. Because in the simplest sense, evolution is nothing but development. So anyone on any path who's continuing to grow and develop is in one very true sense on an evolutionary path. But the distinctive aspect of evolutionary spirituality is one of context. The question is, how do we contextualize our presence in this world, in these bodies, with all of the propensities that come along with being in a physical world and in a flesh body? And if you think about it, most of the spiritual traditions see this world as a way station at best. If you want to look at Western Judeo-Christian thinking, often this life is just about getting to heaven. And depending on what that particular religion teaches, everything we do here is really just preparation for our supposed real life in heaven. If you want to take the New Age version, life in this world is often seen as an illusion to be escaped from, a trap that we got involved with, and some cosmic error at the dawn of time, and we've been trying to get our way out of it ever since. This world is not seen as having purpose other than as a place for us to outgrow it. And evolutionary spirituality would say, wait a minute, is it possible? Is it possible that this vast cosmos, I mean, it's inconceivable when we imagine the number of worlds that are out there. When we start thinking of the size of the universe, we come to distances that so boggle the mind that it kind of fries the circuits.
Right.
Is it possible that all of this is nothing but a schoolhouse for us? Evolutionary spirituality would say, what if the overarching cosmic reality that we call God has been up to something at least since the Big Bang? And what if our greatest meaning and purpose is actually to be found here in this, well, it's often messy and challenging world of flesh and blood and clashing cultures and political upheavals and physical ailments and weaknesses, all the limitations, in other words, that the three-dimensional experience imposes on us. What if in the midst of those, something is happening, something of a creation that didn't just happen once at the beginning, but that is actually still in process? Evolutionary spirituality holds that there is, in fact, one evolution, evolution of cosmos, biological world, consciousness. It's not a disconnected evolution of souls who are kind of rattling around in bodies till they can get out, but a human race where we can find the evolutionary frontier. And that frontier, by the way, is consciousness breaking forth into matter.
Right.
So as we become increasingly conscious, we are the leading edge of an evolution that's been happening and continues to happen, as I say, at least as far away or long ago as the Big Bang.
Wow. That's wonderfully put. And it really puts us at the center of our own individual and collective, you know, evolution. And it really appeals to both the scientific and spiritual paths, which is, you know, great because quantum physics has shown that consciousness is, you know, the foundation of matter.
Well, you know, Brent, that's a really good point you bring up, because one of the positive side effects, I think, of the evolutionary spiritual path is that it holds great promise of uniting the efforts of science and spirituality, theist and non-theist, because even though the different groups of people may differ in whether they believe that there is an underlying spiritual reality to things, whether they believe that there's life after death, whether they believe there's a God or not, all of those things that might separate the scientist from the person of spiritual consciousness, the theist from the atheist. All of us can, from our understanding, work toward evolution in a very cooperative way. So right. It holds a lot of promise to unify things.
Absolutely.
Right now, I think especially, a lot of us can be tempted to feel pretty helpless about events in the world.
Right.
We're looking at so many crises. We're looking at ecological crises and political crises and economic crises and social crises. You know, we could go on and on. And one of the places where we have leverage is at that level of consciousness. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, that that means we just kind of sit back and do nothing. But we have that old adage that I believe began with Einstein, has been given a lot of different versions, but you can't solve a problem at the same level of consciousness that created it.
And we'll be right back with more from Lynn Sparrow Christie here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Lynn Sparrow Christie on evolutionary spirituality.
Right.
And as long as the human race remains where it is, at its current level of consciousness, we will produce endless variations of the same non-solutions to our problems. We will, as a human race, continue to kick the can down the road, so to speak. But if we can really get on board with that movement to higher level of consciousness, there are solutions that we can't imagine from where we are now that can break forth and bring a whole new level of solution and actually breaking forth from the chaos of current conditions into something completely new.
Right. And what have you found in your personal life and all those around you have been your best tools for helping you to kind of break through into a new way of thinking?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, and it's true of virtually any deep spiritual path, but there is no getting around it, and that is a commitment to meditation. You know, the spiritual path tends to spawn a lot of seeking information. Go to the next conference, read the next book, have the next discussion, listen to the next interview. And all of that is great. And I hope people listen to this interview and I hope they buy my book. But that is not the place where it really happens ultimately. As we make that commitment to regular meditation, it really does something to our consciousness. And so that's foundational. Beyond that, it becomes really important that we grow beyond ego. That word is one that has many, many different contexts, but when I use the word ego, I'm using it roughly the same way Edgar Cayce talked about self with a small s. We are, all of us, collections of many, many false identities that could be considered the masks of ego. We think we are what we're feeling at the moment, but we're not. We think we are this carefully constructed self-image, but we're not. And part of the work of evolution on a personal level is to become better and better at spotting the false ego self and being willing to challenge it, to kind of move up to a level where we can watch ourselves being the ego almost with amusement. Oh, there she goes again. Watch that. Has a way of taking a lot of the power out of ego. And it's a never-ending process, by the way. If anybody claims, oh, I've overcome my ego, I'd be a little bit skeptical.
Right.
Because ego gets more and more sneaky in its disguises. And ego has some very clever disguises. One of its cleverest is the conscientious spiritual seeker. The moment that becomes an identity that we revel in and cling to, it's a disguise of ego.
Right.
There's always a deeper self, and being willing to ruthlessly challenge the false self and continue that process toward the authentic self is a core evolutionary practice. Another is one, and this one almost happens, I think, as a manifestation of evolution, but we can do certain things to encourage it, and that is increasing the reach of who and what we care about. You know, when a child is born, a newborn baby, for example, is 100% self-absorbed. That infant cares about nothing but having its needs met. It is kind of comes expecting those needs to be met, and that's appropriate for that developmental stage. As a child grows, there is an increasing ability to see things from the other person's point of view. That's one of the predictable stages of healthy psychological development.
Right.
No longer is everything as it is through my eyes. And that ability to expand your point of view tends to move out in circles. First, you're able to do that with respect to people who you associate with, your family members, later on the people who are part of your social circle, later on the people who are part of your larger ethnic or racial group. Beyond that, your nation. And beyond that, the world. And beyond that, all beings on the world, the planet. In other words, as we evolve, our care begins to push prior limits in who and what we are touched by, compassionate toward, and recognize as being equally important to ourselves.
Right. Wow. And you can never say enough about how important more love in your life is, and I think that kind of goes hand in hand with that.
I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly right. I didn't say it, but that is the core.
Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing that's very, very interesting, particularly I think it would be to people involved with the Casey work, one of the things that is very prominent in a lot of contemporary evolutionary circles is the power of group work, that there are certain leaps that can only happen when we come together in intentional groups with others, that the next stage of evolutionary development, by the way, is full-blown self-reflective consciousness breaking forth into unity consciousness, where more and more we are able to participate with others in a shared experience of consciousness. And that can only happen as we get more and more involved with one another in intentional groups. So there we have Casey back in the early 30s proposing group work and bringing forth a series of Search for God lessons as a kind of core curriculum for working in a small group. And there's a lot of ratification of the validity of that in some of the contemporary intentional groups that are part of the evolutionary spirituality movement.
Right. Wow. And this idea of evolutionary spirituality that is the theme of your upcoming book, is this a new idea to the 21st century, or is this, you know, like you said, everything under the sun isn't necessarily new?
Right. It has become very popular in the past couple of decades, and increasingly so even as we speak. However, the idea has roots that go pretty far back, long before Darwin published his Origin of the Species. The idea of biological evolution was being batted around. There were those biologists who were the so-called immutabilists. That is, they thought that the forms of life were immutable, unchangeable, that God created them a certain way in the beginning, and they have always been that way. And there were the evolutionists who believed that there had been gradual changes to the animal forms on the earth. Also, long before Darwin, in the world of philosophy, something interesting was happening. The ancient view of time was cyclic. People saw the seasons coming and going. They saw themselves as kind of caught in a cyclic world where everything kept returning in that seasonal kind of way that it was so important to early agrarian societies. But a more developmental view was coming forward. As far back as the 1600s, for example, the philosopher Leibniz said that there, well, to give you a quote, a perpetual and unrestricted progress of the universe as a whole must be recognized. And he said it advances to a higher state of development. And the German philosopher Schelling had written that history as a whole is a progressive, gradually self-disclosing revelation of the absolute. So we have a lot of philosophical schools, particularly in among the idealists, that were positing that there is an ongoing forward movement to things rather than a continuous cycle. And then one of the really early profound evolutionary worldviews came through with the early theosophical writers of the late 19th and early 20th century, that there is in theosophy a very complex view where lower life forms give rise to higher, the simpler to the more complex, the less conscious to the more conscious. And in fact, Alice Bailey's book, The Consciousness of the Atom, is absolutely amazing, given that it was first published in 1906.
Wow.
In light of, and by the way, that's a public domain book you can get free on Kindle. It's worth taking a look at.
Yeah.
Giving you a sense of how the atom as a small unit has consciousness of a sort. And she traces how as the atoms come together into cells, which come together into life forms, that development of consciousness. And she suggests, as I think many theistic contemporary evolutionaries would say, that as we allow the fullness of our human consciousness to develop, we then are on the brink of the divine consciousness.
Wow.
The American transcendentalists were evolutionary in their thinking. Mm-hmm. And the Hindu sage, Sri Aurobindo, took the Hindu philosophy and put it in a very beautiful evolutionary context where the attainment of nirvana isn't just so that you can be blissful and enjoy being in nirvana, that it equips you then to be a conscious agent of evolution.
And we'll be right back with more from Lynn Sparrow Christie here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Lynn Sparrow Christie on evolutionary spirituality.
Well, one book that Edgar Cayce recommended was Cosmic Consciousness by Richard Buck. And he places this breaking forth of more and more capacity for cosmic consciousness as an evolutionary breakthrough. Gopi Krishna, again from the Hindu tradition, who has written extensively on the Kundalini, casts the whole awakening Kundalini and the Kundalini energy as actually an evolutionary force. And then if we want to return to the Christian tradition, the French paleontologist priest Pierre Thierry de Chardin has a sweeping evolutionary view. He died in the 60s, and during his life, he was not permitted to publish his findings. The church that he remained faithful to would not allow it. But after his death, his works were published, and his work on evolution, he has a wonderful book called The Phenomenon of Man, traces this whole process of biological and spiritual evolution as the same evolution. And he posits a coming of what he calls the omega point, where there is a unification of consciousness.
Wow. Yeah, he's one of my favorite. I call it his manifesto. It's a very short, about 80-page book called Building the Earth, and I read it every single year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's
just to
great.
Keep me inspired and keep focused, you know, to continue to be a part of the evolutionary, you know, path that's going on here.
Everyone, Everyone should read him. He is fabulous.
Yeah, he's amazing. And what did you find about this evolutionary path in the Casey material?
Well, you know, here's something that has astounded me again and again over the years. Many times we get introduced to the Casey material and we're seeing it through the lens of where we are at the time. And if we're not careful, we can think that the lens that we use to understand and to some degree limit what's in the Casey material is all there is. And we find something wonderful and new out there. And what I've found again and again is each time that's happened to me, I go back to the Casey readings and lo and behold, it was there all along and I just hadn't quite, it hadn't gelled for me. And that was certainly true with the evolutionary perspective. And the one thing that's been hiding in plain sight is the fact that Edgar Casey repeatedly called God, not only God, but creative force.
Right.
That's an evolutionary statement in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really interesting reading that suggested that God rested on the seventh day in the creation story in order to let God's purposes flow through what had been made. And then the interesting clause, that it might be made perfect, which suggests a teleological or a outcome-oriented approach that, in truth, that metaphor of 6 days of creation followed by a day of rest on God's part is almost like, okay, I got the ball rolling. Now, what are you going to do to carry it through?
Right. Wow, I like that.
And, you know, the other thing that I haven't been able to find out if Casey was the first one to use this term because it's so ubiquitous now, but if he wasn't the first, he was one of the earliest users of the term co-creator. And when you think about it, every single time those readings remind us that our role is to be a co-creator with God, which they certainly do again and again and again, that's an evolutionary perspective. Because if creation was done and we're just sort of waiting to get ourselves out of here, you know, the earth kind of becomes the penal colony for wayward souls, and when we serve our time, we get to break free, that's not really what the co-creative idea would suggest, that we are here in order to be a part of the whole creative process.
Right. Wow. And in your book, you speak of the human race as being at a frontier or on the verge of the next evolutionary development. That's very inspiring to read something like that.
Well, the idea is, and it goes back to the idea that the whole thing happening here in this manifest or three-dimensional world or the world of form, depending on what terminology you're using, that it is about consciousness breaking forth in matter. Now, it's not that there is no consciousness in, let's say, a piece of furniture, because if consciousness and matter are kind of two sides of the same reality, some form of rudimentary consciousness must be present in the atom, for example.
Right.
And certainly Edgar Casey spoke of there being consciousness in the cell. But consciousness is not an on or off kind of situation. Consciousness is a matter of degree. And so there is a certain consciousness in a plant, let's say, that's more than the consciousness of a rock, in that a plant can respond to its environment. It can turn toward the sun. It can shrink from a natural enemy and so on. There is greater consciousness still in some of the instinctive life of the lower animals. There's greater consciousness in, many of us would say, in some of the higher mammals, our pets. Any of us who have a pet would certainly know that there is consciousness. That animal is not just operating under instinctive forces.
Right.
And, you know, we used to think that we were the only ones who had language, and, of course, that's being blown away
right.
by some of the research with animals adopting language. We used to think that we were the only ones who could problem solve. Well, that's being blown away. You know, you can watch some of these science specials where crows know how to drop pebbles in a glass of water to raise the fruit at the bottom to the top so they can get at it. I saw something last night where otters were learning to use rocks to crack open shells of shellfish.
Right.
That's making tools.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that there is consciousness in all of this material world, and the consciousness becomes more sophisticated and more complex as the neurology becomes more complex. There is a coevolution of our physical being, our biological, our neurological being, with consciousness itself. Now, what appears to be still the sole domain of humans is what we could call self-reflective consciousness. That is, not only the ability to be conscious, but to be conscious that we are conscious. So that your dog may have a reaction to you giving a treat to another dog and not to him, but he probably doesn't have the capacity to think that is not fair. He probably doesn't have the abstraction to have a sense of fairness and realize it's been violated. He knows something's happened that he doesn't like, but the other animals appear, and notice I'm being careful here because we're always learning new things about what they are capable
right,
of, but
right.
they appear not to be able to reflect on their own mortality, for example. Animals probably don't speculate what happens when I die. Animals probably don't speculate what was here before I was born. They probably don't speculate what will be here after I die. Those are all functions of consciousness being able to reflect back on itself, to operate on itself, so to speak. For much of the frontier, it is still the expansion of our ability for self-reflective awareness. And that goes back a bit to this growing beyond ego, because when we are in the many masks of ego, we're not being self-reflective in our consciousness. We're blind to our stuff, to put it in the vernacular. The more we can reflect on ourselves and what we're doing, the more self-reflective consciousness grows. But then that big frontier, the next step beyond self-reflective consciousness, is that breaking forth into unity consciousness. As Edgar Cayce would have described it, to know ourselves, to still be ourselves, and yet be one with
right.
the greater reality.
Wow. To me, it makes me think of the reason why so many things are in, you know, quote-unquote turmoil right now, and there's such a shaking up, you know, socially, economically, religiously, is because we're at a time where we need to become more self-reflective, so the world is reflecting more of the things that we need to kind of wake up and become aware of.
Yeah, I would
yeah.
agree.
Yeah.
yeah. And to the degree that it's still them out there doing it, and we're all, I think most of us are guilty of it to some degree, it's those people in Congress, whether we say it's this party, the other party, or both parties, it's still them doing it to us.
Right.
And the idea of knowing that we are participants in a collective consciousness, and part of this seizing the opportunity of the chaos on our times is saying, all right, what version of that I can see out there is actually operating within me? It makes up my personal blindness.
And we'll be right back with more from Lynn Sparrow Christie here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Lynn Sparrow Christie on evolutionary spirituality.
As we overcome something within ourselves, we're doing it not just for ourselves, and this kind of loops back to the wider context of evolutionary spirituality. We're doing it on behalf of the race and, for that matter, the planet. If every time I am able to, no matter how much it hurts, do what the more authentic self would do rather than what the small self wants to do, it's that much easier for someone else to do that same thing.
Right.
And similarly, every time I somehow find within me the wherewithal to do the more conscious thing, I am standing on the shoulders of those who already got that, those who've already done it. We both draw on the achievements of those who have already done what we're still learning how to do, and then we add to the collective momentum for those who have not yet been able to accomplish what we are now right on the cusp of accomplishing. So it works both ways.
Right. How wonderfully inspiring is that? I love that.
Yeah. And you know, one of the best parts is that it takes us as flawed people and says that's okay, because so is everyone else flawed. You don't have to be a paragon, and that's it. Evolutionary spirituality can, if we're not really careful, sound like an elitist philosophy, like, oh, well, we're the leading edge of evolution. We're the ones, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, that's an egoic co-opting of the evolutionary perspective.
Right.
The less egoic version says that as a flawed human being who is still struggling with a lot of the instinctual tendencies of my evolutionary past, be it selfishness or self-protection or greed or whatever it might be, I have an opportunity to face how I can grow beyond this. And in so doing, I'm becoming a part of a collective humanity that is doing the same thing. I'm doing my part. I'm putting my oar in the water. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to be better than anybody. All I have to do is be willing to put my own oar in the water for the sake of the whole.
Right. Wow, that's wonderful. And I understand, last but not least, you will be speaking at the ARE here in Virginia Beach on Saturday, December 7th.
Yes.
And it's for a conference called Christ and Christmas Today, Experiencing the Kingdom Within. And is this talk that you're going to do related to the material in your book?
It is and it isn't. Casey had really interesting things to say about the soul that's best known to the world as Jesus who became the Christ. And in fact, that is an evolutionary story. It has a lot to say about the evolution that we're all involved in. But that topic is so huge, it can't be tackled in one conference presentation. And in fact, I had to even leave it out of the book and save it for the sequel. However, we can explore the implications of Advent and the Christmas story as archetypes for everyone on the spiritual path, because we all have a Mary aspect that's called to gestate and birth the Christ. We all have a Joseph who's called to accept things that might confound our cultural expectations and fly in the face of convention to care for the Mary within us and the Christ child she's bringing forth. We all have wise men who know how to look for the signs and follow the star. And we all make choices every day to either nurture or deny those parts of ourselves. So the opportunity, as I see it, during Advent and Christmas is to draw on the strengthening of those archetypes that is actually more possible at that time of year, because one of the principles is, as a lot of people are focusing on something, it does become more accessible. So it's the perfect time of year to make the archetype, you might say the metaphors of the Christ story, are archetypes for all of our growth. It's an opportunity to make those real in our own experience. So that's what my session at this particular conference is about.
Wow. That's great. And is there anything else that you're working on right now?
Well, as I just kind of mentioned in passing, as I had to leave out material on the evolutionary story of the soul we know of as Jesus who became the Christ, I was actually starting my research files for what will be a sequel to this book, and it's the rest of the evolution story, and particularly as Edgar Cayce describes the evolutionary development of that soul. I also have a Edgar Cayce e-group on the topic of evolutionary spirituality. It's called The Path of the Co-Creator, and that will be coming up in early 2014 at the end of February. And then another e-group that I'm busily updating because I've been offering it now for a few years It's called Apprentice to the Master, Following Jesus in the Third Millennium. And that takes a perspective that the path of following Jesus isn't about adopting a set of beliefs. It's modeled more on the guru-student model, where Jesus is the master, and we are his disciples, truly, in the sense of learning from him and becoming like him. And Edgar Cayce has lots and lots to say about that. So that e-group is coming up in the second half of 2014, and to take it and update it is also currently part of what I'm working on.
Wow. Great. Look forward to all that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I look forward to doing it all.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for writing this book and continuing to put in the effort to inspire people, because it truly is inspiring listening to you. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Brent. I enjoyed talking to you.
Well, that's all the time we have for the show today. A big thank you goes out to Lynn Sparrow Christie for sharing with us a glimpse into her upcoming book entitled Beyond Soul Growth, Awakening to the Call of Cosmic Evolution. Don't forget to pick up a copy and to learn more about online learning e-groups mentored by Lynn and other Cayce scholars. You can visit the ARE website at edgarcayce.org, that's edgarcayce.org/e-groups, that's e-groups, groups. To learn more about Lynn, you can visit her website at accessyourpotential.net. And on behalf of everyone here at the Association for Research and Enlightenment, I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff, encouraging you to continue seeking your path and sharing your unique gifts as a co-creator. And remember, every thought in the mind is a planted seed. Be mindful of your garden and what thoughts you're actually nurturing. And just remember, don't beat yourself up along the way. Any and all progress is always accounted for in spiritual evolution. Have a wonderful, love-filled week, everybody.